This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 189, where we're going to interview Paul Schaeflein about architecture and development in the cloud, recorded live April 13th, 2017.
ShareGate makes it easier for organizations to adopt and use the latest Microsoft productivity tools, helping millions of users be happier and more productive at work. ShareGate is trusted by over 10,000 IT admins from over 110 countries to manage, migrate, and secure their SharePoint and Office 5 environments. ShareGate is recognized as the must-have tool for day-to-day administration of on-premises, cloud, and hybrid environments. Interested in learning more? Check us out at ShareGate.com to learn how ShareGate can make you more productive.
AC.
Hey, CJ.
What's going on?
Oh, I'm finally home.
You've been away a while. Where did you go and where did you end up?
It's been a very long 2 weeks. It started about a little over two weeks ago, and I flew out to Seattle for the for a Microsoft SharePoint Developer Kitchen or Dev Kitchen, and that's where they kind of bring people in to see where they're going and get a lot of feedback, real rough and early bits and stuff to see what stuff is coming. And we were specifically, most of it was about SharePoint framework stuff, so it's pretty cool. I was actually there with who we're going to be interviewing today. But that was the first one. I did that from, I guess, a Tuesday or a Wednesday through a Saturday, and then flew to Austin, Texas for the SP TechCon conference, where I was there for about, I was only supposed to be there for about 4 days. Ended up being there for a lot longer because I got stuck in the whole mess of the Delta meltdown that happened, where I tried to get home, tried to fly home on Wednesday of last week, and then fly back out on Saturday for a conference I was at earlier this week. And that didn't go as planned. Had multiple cancellations of flights, and then finally got to Vegas this past weekend. Was in Vegas for a little conference called MicroConf for entrepreneurs and startups and marketing and stuff. And finally got home yesterday. And after my nice 15-day trip, I got the classic Las Vegas, I'm not a smoker, but apparently I need a pack of Marlboro Reds to bring me down from my nicotine high for the last week.
Yeah. And the you're going cold turkey.
Yeah, yeah, and freezing cold air conditioning and
nice.
I'm finally home.
I feel for you. Well, glad to hear you made it back.
Yeah, made it back. How about you? What you been up to?
Quite a bit. Yeah, we've been pretty smashed. We got a big release out this week for Hyperfish. We're recording this on Thursday, and Tuesday I'd sort of penciled in as an all-nighter getting this release out. Fortunately, it didn't go that long. But we put out a big release on Tuesday night around some new features that we've been working on for the last couple of months. So really nice to take a deep breath after that. Everything kind of went smoothly. A couple of little wrinkles, but nothing serious. And nice to take a deep breath after a couple of months of really crazy work and getting this out. So really excited about seeing the back of that and it getting it out into customers' hands. It's very satisfying to ship. So I'm pleased we did.
Yeah, I know we talked a little bit earlier today about all your, the experience of, and how much of an impact it was in the rollout you guys had. It was definitely, if I was in charge of that release, I would have definitely had the pucker factor going on Tuesday night, being quite nervous about how significant of an update you guys ran.
Yeah, we decided to lump a lot of things in, right? We did database upgrades during it. We did all sorts of things. So normally we release every week to production, if not more quickly. This was just a big one, right? So yeah, pucker factor increases for sure. Nice.
Welcome to the cloud.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So today on the show, we are lucky enough to have a special guest, Paul Schaeflein, who has been very kind enough to join us on the show. And we're going to talk to him about architecture and development in the cloud. But before we do that, we just want to break for a moment to hear from one of our fantastic sponsors.
The Microsoft Cloud Show is sponsored by Valid.nl. Valid's motto is stay ahead. Its mission is to enable its customers to excel in their business through the innovative use of IT. Valid is always on the lookout for new colleagues. If you're interested in all things happening at Azure, whether in infrastructure, SQL Server, Office 365, Power BI, SharePoint, or .NET, look them up on valid.nl.
All right, welcome back. So, Paul Schaeflein is a solution architect and developer with experience in all versions of SharePoint platform. He has more than 3 decades of experience in architecting, designing, and developing software solutions, and this experience covers a vast array of technologies, languages, and industries. He's a top-rated speaker, having presented at SharePoint Evolutions, SharePoint Evolutions Roadshow, the SharePoint Conference, TechEd, and numerous user groups, and in recognition of his seriously awesomeness, he's been awarded Microsoft Most Valuable Professional 6 times. And welcome to the show, Paul Schaeflein.
Well, thank you. It's a little different when you hear that read back to you. Thanks for doing it.
Sounds a bit different with a Kiwi accent. Yeah,
well, I love it, though. Sounds Kiwi. Much better.
Sounds like, I thought it was Indian.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. So yeah, thanks for coming on the show. We're really pleased to get you on the Cloud Show. And yeah, thanks for joining us on your afternoon, I take it, where you are. Where are you, by the way?
I am in Chicago, home of the Chicago Blackhawks.
Excellent. Oh, very nice.
Yes. First game tonight.
I believe I have a special gift that I will take a screenshot of shortly and post as part of the blog post for this this podcast that Paul very nicely left for me when he visited Hyperfish HQ a couple of weeks ago. So yeah, but again, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So today we want to talk to you about cloud development and specifically building solutions in a cloud world. You know, as longtime listeners of the show will attest to, we talk a bunch about cloudy stuff, but sometimes we talk about on-premy stuff. And we felt like it would be a really good opportunity to talk to somebody who's in the thick of it day to day on building and architecting solutions for the cloud, but has deep roots in building and architecting solutions for on-premises. And what better person to talk to about that than you and discuss kind of some of the ins and outs and issues and common things you see people face as they sort of transition in this world from being able to do anything on their IIS box under their desk at work to building stuff for the cloud. So I guess, why don't you kick things off with telling us a little bit more about yourself and then some of the projects and things you've been working on, you know, only as far as you can go with those, but just to give us a sort of a sense for the kinds of issues and things you think people face and when they're thinking about this stuff.
Yeah, certainly. So there's a couple different ways to look at this. And obviously, with the adoption of Office 365 ramping up in cloud in general, right? So, you know, a lot of people who are moving to the cloud, but it's never a turn it off and then turn it on over there, right? As much as people would love to just have a, you know, go to home on Friday on prem and come in on Monday, be in the cloud, it doesn't work that way, right? And so the world of hybrid is where to go. And somewhere, so I heard someone say hybrid is the new normal, right? So while there's a lot to be considered for end users and IT pros in that world too, but developers too, right? I can't just run my code wherever I want, or even if I do, I need to understand that I might need to reach out somewhere else. So it certainly has been an eye-opener and for some people, and you get some struggles in a lot of different areas as well. So I've been helping clients do that lately, both on-prem development stuff and obviously Office 365 migrations, but then what do? I have all kinds of code that either runs in SharePoint, which we know that story is well told, but maybe I have a BCS connection to something on-prem, or maybe I have some other system running in a manufacturing plant that I need to aggregate data from. And somehow, some way, I need to figure out a way to get this in front of my users, and my users aren't where I can control them, you know, from start to finish anymore. They could be floating out in a browser somewhere. So I see that's a common pattern, and the way that we would solve these problems today is different than what we used to. So that's I think we might have a story we can tell here. And obviously, you working on a cloud vendor have come across these as well. So I'm sure you're very familiar with it. But again, it's just something that the guys who sit in the office all day and just answer the phone, and put out the fires, maybe aren't thinking this way or want to know what they should do next, right?
Yeah. Do you think there are some sort of broad categories of not really issues, but more areas that really need to be deeply thought about in the transition between on-prem and the cloud? So for example, you know, infrastructure is obviously one in terms of what the stuff's going to run on, but what are some of the other big sort of categories or overarching buckets of things people need to think about in that regard? I mean, you mentioned, you know, how you get access to your data, for example. That seems like a fairly sort of fundamental one. Are there any other kind of big broad buckets like that you think crop up when you're designing a solution like that?
So anyone who knows me knows what the first answer is going to be: identity. How are you going to manage who's at the other end of the pipe, right? That becomes a big issue. And so all these systems need to know who the user is, and ideally it's the same user. So that's number one. Another common one that none of the developers really like to deal with, but logging or exception handling, right? If something goes wrong, well, how do I see it, right? I run into people all the time who love writing to the ULS logs in SharePoint. Say, well, that's great. If you need to look at those logs,
you can't get access to those.
Yeah, that's not going to work, right? And so what do you do that? And there's no silver bullet that I found for distributed logging, although I'm hearing some nice things about some products, but that has to be taken care of. And you know, this is just the what we call the plumbing, right? The core plumbing that you've always done on-prem, you need to think, how is that going to scale outside of the walls of outside my firewall? It's not necessarily an easy thing. And then, of course, a lot of the transition I'm running to, people like me who've been around for quite a while, making sure we have a user interface that's responsive and scalable and modern, if you will, and has framework X and framework Y and whatever. So that's also another big stumbling point, is trying to get things to look good enough.
Are you saying ActiveX controls are no longer a thing?
Or just in general, right? Well, yeah, what have you done, right? I mean, I did run across an ActiveX control a couple weeks ago. It was, they're running a Win32 app on the desktop talking to something, and now they need to get data out of that. So yeah, well, it doesn't look the same. So yeah, it's a struggle.
So some of the other stuff that I've noticed that, you know, with this theme of doing more kind of cloud type architecture and development is that while we can do this on-prem, it's never really seemed to be the dominating way of building applications on-prem or in the cloud. But my observation is we see a lot more people building very loosely coupled systems, that it comes into the challenges like that you mentioned earlier about the distributed logging, the identity and all that, making sure that all of them kind of speak the same language, or they all, at least with those integration points, they all know how to do the same kind of thing. You don't want to have, like, I would assume that you don't want to have like multiple points within your application loosely coupled, but each one of them uses a different logging provider, or each one of them uses a different identity provider. You want to have that kind of shared infrastructure that they all understand. I mean, you see that as a common like challenge for developers that are working on these kinds of systems?
Yes. I mean, that's always question number one, right? Are you synchronizing your identity out to the cloud somewhere? Yes. And as you both know, right, that whole OAuth login dance can be hard. And in some areas, it's easy, right? I just used the ADEL library and it works, for example, in .NET. But what if you're not writing .NET? Now you need to learn how that works. So that is always a struggle to make sure. And as you mentioned, the different identity providers, just as a background on that, right? So for example, if in SharePoint, and we saw this in SharePoint 2010 initially, right? If I log in using Windows NT, my identity provider is my domain controller. But if I log in with an external identity provider using SAML or claims, the identity provider is not your local NT domain. So the application thinks that's two different people. So even though it's the same person, it's looks like two different identities. And so that is a big discussion that I like to have early, as soon as possible, and figure out what's happening here, because almost every organization that is of a decent size has got these types of systems in place, and they may not have considered it to be a big deal because I can log into my domain for this and I can log into the browser for that. But now when you want them to talk to each other, that's where it gets to be a struggle. So yeah, that certainly is the number one thing to look at and make sure it's getting right. And developers can't do that on their own, right?
Yeah.
And in fact, I used to argue developers shouldn't be doing that, right? Who's better at securing your identities? You know, some guy who can sling code around, or somebody who does that for a living, right? So.
And it's funny you say that. I know that you and I have worked on a project together where we kind of watched where someone decided to build their own SDS, and we both were kind of like, wait a minute, why did you do this? And we didn't really, I didn't ask it like that. I know you and I talked about it together, and then we talked to kind of another third party that was involved in it, and their answer was, I think that some people do things because they lack the understanding of how other things are done. And it's like, oh, so you're saying they didn't need to do it? He's like, oh, yeah, pretty much. But I know one of the things that Microsoft has to offer around that, and we've talked a little bit about it on the show, or a good bit about it on the show with Azure Active Directory, they have, would you call it new? I mean, the business-to-business, the B2B capability, or the B2C capability, where you can leverage that for your own applications, not only just for the identity, but between different organizations.
So B2B is, quote, new at G8 this week, or maybe at the end of last week, right? So that certainly is something and can help. again, for those who don't know, the B2B service is designed for business to business. And the idea here is that I have an Azure Active Directory and CJ has an Azure Active Directory and AC has one. But so we each log in with different directories, right? So we're probably not the same identity provider because of the different tenancies. But if I want them to access resources in my tenant, so to speak, I can configure the Azure AD to say, even though the identity provider is CJ's tenant, they're still allowed to come into my resources, and I can get a SID, if you will, for those of you old timers, right? I get it. That's in my directory, securing my resource, even though the person who logs in comes from somewhere else. So that's new. And the conversely, the B2C is for business to consumer, and that's really letting people log in using their Facebook or Gmail accounts or Twitter accounts, OAuth, if you will. And then that gives them a unique identifier in my tenant that I can then use to make authorization decisions for secured resources. So those help. But if I'm working on something on-prem and I want to connect to Office 365, I'm not going to use either one of those two technologies. And most likely, I would be synchronizing to my own directory. So those further muddy the waters, if you will, right? So it's really kind of the discussion to say, well, what systems are talking to each other and who secures them? And to further complicate things, right, if I can have software as a service providers like Salesforce or Box or Dropbox and any of these who have web-based services that I want to integrate with my systems, and so how do I log into those? Are they using the same directory mechanism, or do I need to have something that's going to broker that conversation back and forth? And it really gets to be messy in a hurry. So you want to make sure it works, right? Mm.
Sounds like the buckets that you've mentioned, right, are infrastructure about how you're going to run the thing, identity, how you're going to authenticate with it and authorize it and how people get in. Connectivity to data is probably the next one, right? And that seems like it would be a real fundamental difference, right? Because I go build some code and run it wherever in the cloud, and it just can't connect to my SQL Server or my old Oracle databases or, you know, some spreadsheet sitting in a file share somewhere or whatever it happens to be, right? Whatever the data source happens to be. So what are some of the architectural patterns that you're seeing pop up around how you solve that sort of bucket?
So I'm not seeing too many patterns, plural here. I've seen the industry pretty much coalesce around doing an OData feed of some sort, either using built-in libraries or rolling their own. But at the end of the day, we're putting a web service around it. And that can be web API. It can be any server-side code exposing it. SQL Server has some built-in tools that'll generate an OData feed if you trust that. But again, this kind of, well, a couple things to keep in mind here, right? So number one, just because I put something, a web service around it, and I expose that web service through the firewall in port 443, who am I going to let access those web services, right? Probably not everybody in the internet. So now how do I secure those? And then we're right back to step one, right? What's your identity provider and how are you going to secure those web services?
Yeah, gotcha.
And there is a standard now that has come out called Swagger. For those long-timers, we've had a WSDL, if you're a web services description language, which is the XML version. But Swagger is a JSON document that describes your web services and the data types or shapes, the classes, if you will, for inputs and outputs and the methods that can be called and their security requirements and so on. And so most of the cloud services, especially in the Microsoft world, either Flow or Nintex or Power Apps, can read these documents, these Swagger documents, to understand your web services. And so that's the key takeaway for many people is, hey, people have been talking about service-oriented architecture for a long, long time. Right. And so now we're actually seeing how this works, because if you have a service and you can secure your service and you can describe your service, well, then other people know how to call your service, even though you may not control both ends of that call. So that certainly is the way that we're seeing, that I'm seeing the industry go here.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So I know you mentioned Flow and Power Apps a minute ago. I want to come back to that in a minute, but I wanted to kind of, you know, revisit something else that we were talking about a minute ago. We talked about the different, like, shared services that we have. And we're not talking shared services like old school SharePoint shared services, but like the shared services like logging and identity and stuff. There's going to be times when an application has its own settings that it needs to share that are separate from like identity or with these other providers. And it's just something that you need to, like, maybe for a tenant needs to be able to share these across the entire organization. You know, how do you handle like that idea, that concept of like sharing, like for a service, sharing the different settings across all the places where you've implemented that service?
Again, this gets down to just data, right? And there's a lot of considerations there, whether it's some, if it's an on-prem service and it has a database and I can put data in there, that's great. If it's something that needs to transition across services, right now we're looking at cloud storage of some sort, which gets us right back to the same issues, right? It's yet another external service. And so I found Azure Table Storage to be great, or even a DocumentDB type thing where it's kind of, again, talking to long-time in-house developers, they have relational databases on the brain. And that's another point of conversation. Say, you know, if all you're storing is 17 items about the current user, I don't need to put that in a table, right? Maybe I can store that somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And a little JSON document stored tucked away somewhere is pretty helpful. So that works. There's another, again, in the Microsoft space, there's some a little known capability that's out now is property storage in the Azure Active Directory, and I forgot the official name of it now. I can't believe that, but there's the ability for me to stick some data in the directory for the current user, if you will, that could store like
extensions.
There's open extensions and schema extensions. Thank you. Yes. So there's another option there. If it's something that's tied to a specific user, I can stick information with the same place where their identity comes from. That helps, right? If it's something that's crossing services, again, it depends on, does it need to be outside the firewall, inside the firewall? What's the best approach? And so with thinking along the lines that I'm not making a ADO.net type call, or I'm not making some kind of big collection of records back and forth, I'm doing an HTTP request. And so what does that packet, what does that payload look like, and how do I make it small, and where's a good place to put it? So
yeah, gotcha. On that previous comment you made about web services and wrapping data sources and things like that and exposing them, do you see anybody sort of short-circuiting that by doing things like site-to-site VPNs into Azure and stuff like that to kind of go, oh, I mean, what's their hesitation? I imagine the security guys like all over that, like the proverbial on a blanket, right? Like I bet he's like, no way are we sticking holes in our firewalls and data access to potentially sensitive product information or proprietary organization information in a web service exposed on the internet. Is anybody trying to circumvent that or sort of short circuit it by doing things like site-to-site VPNs into where their code runs up in Azure and so forth?
I've seen that, again, depending on the industry and the customer, exactly right. So if I'm running infrastructure as a service, then that makes perfect sense, right? You can do a VPN from your data center to Microsoft's data center and get that stuff kind of in there. But again, it kind of depends on what the application you're running. If I need to integrate with Salesforce, can I do a VPN to Salesforce? I'm not sure that's going to work, right? And even a VPN to Office 365, and I'm not so sure is 100% there. So those are all concerns. But what I'm finding generally is most information security departments are mostly okay with, HTTPS or TLS connection across things and making sure that they have updated certificates. So except for the super sensitive people, and they probably aren't moving everything to the cloud anyway, so some of their systems are still on their own network,
gotcha.
So that's less of an issue. But most of them, I think, are pretty okay with doing secure calls over the internet.
Hey, before we move on, let's take a brief break to chat to one of our great sponsors.
While many IT teams struggle with the impact of deploying Office 365, Zscaler customers are experiencing 40% or greater network performance across file download times, as well as TCP and DNS connection times, compared to using next-gen firewalls and UTMs to route Office 365 traffic locally to the internet. While you may know Zscaler is a leader in cloud security, they also have hundreds of customers who are processing over 1.2 petabytes of Office 365 traffic monthly through the Zscaler cloud. Visit www.zscaler.com to learn more.
Okay, Paul, a couple of minutes ago, we touched a little bit on Flow and Power Apps. In the past, CJ and I have sat down with Laura Rogers to talk a little bit about Flow and Power Apps. You know, I know that we have, and we talked a little bit about it with Ryan Duguid as well in a recent episode. You know, I know that when you're building a big application or a big system, there's inevitably you're going to have some sort of a process or like a process you want to be able to instrument that's going to have multiple inputs, or maybe it's got to, you know, run for a little bit and wait for some additional input and then continue on. You know, in the past we've done this. I'm sure a lot of our listeners are familiar with SharePoint. And so in the past we've used SharePoint's workflow capabilities or the things that SharePoint relies on to do workflow, or maybe look to an outside service. And you know, lately we've seen in the last year or so, Microsoft come out with a new service called Flow, where it's kind of replacing, at least in my mind, it's replacing what we used to do with workflow inside of SharePoint. Have you spent much time with Flow and like so far? And if so, I mean, what's your impression of Microsoft Flow?
It's a necessary evil. It's a terrific tool for those who don't necessarily write code like I do, right? So I don't use it a lot, but I have poked around with the service to see what's there. And here's where it kind of fits into this new hybrid world, if you will, right? So I had a customer say, well, they're dealing with external sharing in SharePoint, and that's a whole nother show that we could do if you wanted to, but they wanted to do some approvals around that, right? Well, who wants to write code to do approvals, right? I mean, I'll take your money if you want to pay me to do that. But that's really kind of a known commodity, right? And so because it's one of, again, a different way to think about things, well, there's a service in the cloud, two of them, right, that we know of that can do approvals. So why not integrate those, right? And so in this scenario where they wanted to do external sharing, it was you'd say, well, you're in SharePoint, so let's create a list and add an item to the list, and we'll run a flow. Well, what the flow didn't do was talk to Azure AD in a way that we wanted. So, hey, guess what? I could write a web service to do that and describe the web service and bring it into flow. And now you have an action or an activity. I can never remember the name, but I have this action inside of flow that calls my custom code to do whatever business requirement I have, right? So it's really not much different. I can sell this to a power user in SharePoint the same way, saying, well, it's a workflow, and you have this new action that you just say, hey, make a call to this thing and pass in data, and you pick the properties from the list, and it's just what we've always done, right? And I can talk to the developers and say, you know what, you're just writing a web service. You know, load up a web API, deploy it to Azure, describe it with this document, and everyone's happy that it all works, right? So I think I'll probably change my perception of flow just because I can see it being a great way to instrument or broker the calls between these various services. And right, isn't that what workflow is doing, right? And even in, I listened to the talk with Ryan, and that was with their cloud service, and that was one of the things. Hey, yeah, I can see their approach. I like that approach on how to integrate with these systems, and I can play in that party. So why would I not want to do that, right?
The classic developer answer, right? It's like, why would I want to use it? I'm sure I could build one better.
Yeah, I probably could, but is it the right choice, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think one of the key things there is being able to integrate with other things, right? So if you use a tool like that, it sounds like out of the box you get some connectors to different things, but you know, some of those connectors could be your own little microservices that do additional bits and pieces.
Yeah, exactly. There's a microservice approach, right? It's been around for a long time, and I'm sure there's more formal ways to do that. But here's another, what I call a microservice approach that I found helpful is that, so back in the day when SharePoint add-ins were first released, right, you would end up registering them in your tenant, and it would be secured with certificate. And those certificates expired in 2 years. And I don't know anybody who remembered that until 2 years and 1 day later when they stopped working. And so
The
patterns and practices. I do remember a lot of people that were affected by it.
Yes. Right. And so the patterns and practices group, they wrote this little tenant information portal website that you could load up and give it permission to your tenant. And it would go and inspect your directory and say, hey, here's all the principles that are going to expire in the next 90 days. You should probably think about those, right? So where does microservices come in? I wrote a little web job that's going to go through and just query those every day and make a call through the Office 365 connector framework to open a conversation in a group or a team that says, hey, this thing's going to expire in 30 days. So I view that as a microservice. It's a little bitty piece of code that wakes up once a day, makes a call to the directory with an if statement, and makes a second call to the service, and it's done, right? And now my administrators group can handle, right? If you like things in your inbox, you can register with a group and subscribe to the group, and you get an email. If you want to have your chat window pop up in Teams, you could certainly do that. And again, it's just another little way to connect all these systems together, trying to get in front of users who are busy doing whatever it is they do for a living, right?
Yeah, gotcha.
Let software do the work of the stuff that you have to do, the repetitive stuff. I mean, that makes it a lot easier than you having to remember, you know, oh, this certificate's about to expire, or this, you know, it's only got a certain timeline on it, and then our time frame on it. Let the software do the work that's really just an automated task that doesn't need to be, you know, someone doesn't need to put a little post-it note on their machine to say, don't forget to do this. Of course, they're on vacation, post-it note's closed in the laptop. They're going to miss it.
Yeah, right, exactly. And if you think about when I'm trying to make calls across systems, you always have that the response problem, I used to call it, right? So if I was doing VB or C++ or something, and I get an exit code of 0, which was good, right? And then we all have all kinds of return true or return false. I remember that whole discussion way back in the day. Well, nowadays it's HTTP status, right? I'm doing some work and I make a call, and if it comes back 200, I'm done. If it doesn't, I know what to do next, right? So think about, again, I'm just building on the shoulders of people who've gone before me, and this is a common well-understood discussion or language, if you will, right? I can do retries if I need to because I get a status code that makes sense. And
speaking of status codes, I got a status code 0 from the graph the other day. Try to make that out. I got HTTP status code 0.
Was it the first, second, or third digit?
It's just one digit.
Oh, that's not good.
Just 0.
Yeah.
There's no way. There's no Wikipedia friends. Has no entry for that. I'm looking at it right now. There's no way.
Yeah, no, exactly. I didn't think it was real anyway. But anyway, sorry to interject.
What you were just mentioning to me, that's exactly what something I'm going through right now. We were joking around before the show that I'm sitting here trying with a head cold, trying to figure out some complex JavaScript to basically synchronize three systems together. Because I don't have access to the server side of any of them. All I can do is client side. So they all load, they all have their own little widget that pops up in the page, and I'm trying to add my extra widget that runs after them. One of them, you got to go grab some stuff and go update data in one system, but then you got to make sure that it's also updated somewhere else based on the response you get back. And then the third one is the infuriating one, which I say it's got a little event where, hey, let me know when everything is done or when you've gotten the data back so that you can go do, you know, the next step in the chain. But of course, it gets all the data except for one of the other things, which is getting their key. So it's, let's get all the data. And then it tells me you have all the data, but then I go get one thing and it's like, yeah, that thing's not there yet. So I have to do like this little loop of waiting, like wait till that guy gets his data. But all that stuff is just such a pain. And I like this model that we're living in more with the cloud kind of hybrid. All the systems are much more disconnected. They're loosely connected. They're not tightly coupled, and everything is much more asynchronous. And so you're doing things with like promises or callbacks. While it can be more confusing and make the system more complicated to build, it seems to me, or at least I prefer it, over the old more tightly coupled one, where if one of the things in the coupling broke, then it was a really bad break. It was hard to be resilient against it. Whereas today, you can put the try and recatch logic in there, and you can do more of, you know, queuing, and one part fails, it doesn't bring down the whole system. It just kind of holds up that part of the process while everything kind of keeps going, and you can get things caught up and you know, backfill. Kind of like my experience in Delta last week, where everything gets backed up and then it takes 4 days for them to get the planes and the pilots and the crew back in place.
You said there just reminds me back to the first question, a common service that you have to have, right? Do you need guaranteed delivery of messages? Do you need a service bus or a queue to make sure that things get processed, right? That's yet another thing we need to make sure, right? Again, while these loosely coupled send an HTTP message is great, what happens if it doesn't go through, right? Is that a big deal, right? So another consideration for you guys is, hey, do I need to have guaranteed delivery? And if so, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, they do that with all the webhook stuff now, that, you know, we're instead of using, like in SharePoint, we had, you know, event receivers, we had remote event receivers, and we had to, you know, make sure our system was up and running and it was good. I mean, I like the way now where we have webhooks where we write something that's going to, the same concept, we're still going to get a post coming to us, but really the idea of the webhook is to be, at least the way I look at them, is that it's supposed to be as simple and as narrow or as shallow as possible, which is just grab the response, throw it on a queue, and then kick back a 200 to tell SharePoint or whoever else it was, I got the response, and then I can go through and deal with it later. To me, it feels like a safer way of doing stuff, and it allows you to kind of get things up and running a little bit quicker. I say that, yet I'm still looking at a queue that I checked this morning. It's got 215,000 items in it because I haven't built the part that processes. It's just trapping everything.
Nice.
One more item on that. If that's new to some listeners and you understand what we're talking about, if you go to the SharePoint webhook documentation page, they have a reference implementation which does exactly what AC says about putting in queues and processing them. And there's some sample code in there too. So that's a great reference if this is all new to you to say, well, what does that really mean? How do I do it? There's some examples out there for you.
Cool. So what do you reckon 2 to 4 kind of key things? If you're a developer today designing or building software for on-prem, maybe it's a SharePoint solution, maybe it's not. What are sort of two to four kind of things that you think they're going to have to get skilled up on real quick when making the transition to the cloud? The things you think that you should they should focus on first?
So if you're going to the cloud, you need to understand identity. And again, it, depending on your cloud host of choice, you may need you could focus on theirs. Maybe you need to know all of them. So that you need to understand as well. These concepts of queuing or service bus, the message transaction delivery, make sure you understand that for sure. You're going to have to understand web technologies, which is more than just HTML and JavaScript, right? So it's quite obvious that you'll be doing some server-side code. So are you going to run an IIS? Are you going to run a Node? Are you going to self-host using .NET Core? Whatever the case may be, there's a lot of choices there. So you need to understand what's the best way to be doing the server-side component of those, of that kind of, not just the client side there as well. And then again, data storage. All right, it's not just rows and columns in a table anymore. There's many different choices, and some may be better for what you're trying to accomplish, and it's worth looking into at least what those are. So off the top of my head, those are the first four things I'd say, hey, start reading up or learning or playing around with these types of things.
Nice. What are you going to throw? You have any you want to throw on that list too, CJ? I got one or two I'd like to do to throw in there as well.
Oh, go for it.
Yeah, so I think another thing, I mean, I agree with everything that Paul said. I would put those probably at the top. And if you're doing any of this style of dev, it's more often than not that you're going to be hosting some or all of your components within one of these public clouds that are available to us between Azure or Google or Amazon, or even if you're just doing infrastructure like servers hosted at one of those public clouds or like at Rackspace or somebody like that. I think it would behoove developers to at least have an idea of what the different services provide so that you know what's available to you. For instance, don't go dive in and go build a lot of stuff that a lot of these, you know, they call them platform as a service, but there's a lot of these different things that are available to you that you don't have to build and have to deal with. I mean, you don't have to install your own version of SQL or Oracle or Postgre or whatever you want to use for your data storage, or you don't have to go build a workflow system or have to go build a queuing system. There are tons and tons of resources, offerings that are out there. Some of them are native to these different cloud providers. Some of them are not exactly native, but they're more like they're still installable software, but they're managed by someone else for you in one of these public clouds. So look to know what's out there, because a lot of the stuff you can just say, I want to leverage this instead of having to maintain my own. And maybe it, you know, it gets you going in a faster direction. You don't have to worry about, you know, scale in a certain sense, because you can throw just more resources and more money at these different things when you have to scale in a really quick time frame.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, good call. Because otherwise, if you end up doing things the same way you used to, you know, you're not really leveraging the fact that you've got access to all those other alternatives that might be better.
Yeah, just moving your cheese.
Yeah. Hey, before we move on to picks, let's hear from one of our great sponsors.
What if you could take any process your teams use to get work done and make it happen automatically? What if you could save countless hours and help people work better together? Nintex can make it happen. With a Nintex platform, work flows from person to person, system to system, to the cloud and back. And it flows in and out of the tools you use every day. With Nintex, work just flows, so your teams can work smarter, work faster, and be more connected than ever.
All right, Paul, we're going to put you on the spot, buddy. We're going to say every show we do what we call picks, and that's usually completely unrelated random stuff for me and vaguely related stuff for AC. That we found interesting or useful or just kind of cause. So, you know, have you gotten a thing that you think our listeners would find interesting that you've come across recently that you thought was really cool?
Yes. So, and since I listened to the podcast, I knew the picks were going to come up. So,
I see.
The first one is a tip I read from Sarah Ford, her blog. She's a longtime Microsoft technologist, and the GitHub folks have put together what they call visualizing Git, and it's a little basic animation thing, right? So if you're reading about Git and branches and commits, and they have these typical ASCII art that shows how everything works together, which is a little bit cool. I like ASCII art. But what does it really mean? Well, they put together this visualizing Git page that lets you issue Git commands. There's no repository. You just enter the Git command, and they have an animation that shows if I do Git branch, it'll create a new circle and draw an arrow to it. And if I do Git commit, it'll move to the next one. And it just kind of helps you understand what happens when you do the various things. And while Git commit...
That's really cool.
Yeah, it gets really cool if you pick... they have a little drop-down. You can say like upstream changes, and it shows you two repos. And if you do a Git pull... it'll show you how it copies data from one rep to the other, repo to the other. It's really helpful to give you just a little visualization, an animation of what it's doing. And you can just do whatever Git command you want without worrying about screwing up your repo. So that's I find that very helpful.
That's really cool. I like that. I just opened it up in my browser and I'm toying around with it and realizing I'm doing it all wrong.
Just kidding. Paul showed this to me a little while ago when we were at the dev kitchen. And it's a great way to learn this stuff because no matter what graphical tool you use, to me, all the Git graphical tools that I've touched so far, they still make it a little hard to understand when you're doing some of that kind of stuff like rebasing or when you're getting upstream changes or something. Once I prefer using the command line now, but you get no visualization with that. And sometimes it's hard to be able to see that. So this is a really good way of helping someone bridge that gap.
Yeah, and I just want to point out that there's a lot of visualizing Git type blog posts that are trying to give you a different picture of the branch history. This is not what this does. Yeah. So just to be clear, this is really, let me issue a command and see what happens. It's really, really pretty helpful.
Yeah, that's really cool. AC, what about you, buddy?
So my first one is about Visual Studio Code. Actually, both of mine are going to be about Visual Studio. But there is a link that I'll share here from realm.io. It's by a guy named Alex Dima, who is on the Visual Studio Code team and has done a talk at a conference, actually a conference I'm going to be at in a couple weeks, at the GoTo conference. This is from his post. He did a video of it last year at the conference. So the video is up on the blog post that I'll mention. But the title of the post is Visual Studio Code Shipping One of the Largest Microsoft JavaScript Apps. And it was posted earlier in April. And he really goes about explaining, how they used TypeScript to go build Visual Studio Code and how they were using JavaScript and how the challenge of what JavaScript was played, how the code makes it a lot easier using TypeScript. So I found it to be really interesting to see a real world story of how this was done. Again, the blog post is from April 2017, but there's a link to a presentation that he did that's similar to what he did, but it's about a year old. So I'll make sure I put that in the show notes as well.
Very cool. Very cool.
How about you?
I got a pretty cool one. It's called Sense, as in to sense something. It's a smart home monitor that you wire into your power panel, I guess. Is that the right word? Is that the US terminology?
Fuse box.
Is it? Yeah, gotcha. Fuse box. Yeah, cool. Where the power comes into your house, right? And basically you do two things. You clip these little monitors around your incoming lines from the mains, like from outside your house. Clip on these two little adapters around those wires, and they plug into this little box. Then you plug in you wire the box into one of your fuses on the house side of the circuit. And this thing has Wi-Fi, so it connects up to your Wi-Fi and connects to the internet. And it basically watches and monitors all the usage of power going on around your house, and using a whole bunch of machine learning and AI type stuff can start detecting what you've got in your house. So it'll know the fingerprint for power usage for your toaster, for example, and will say, hey, the toaster's on, or hey, the toaster's off. Or for example, be like, oh, there's a light bulb out, or this light is on, or somebody's opened your garage door while you're out, and it can start alerting you about various things going on in your house. Obviously tells you about energy usage in your home, what's sucking usage, what's on and off and all that sort of stuff. So that's pretty cool, I thought. Like, kind of means that you don't need to put sensors on all of your things in your house to know what they're up to.
That's very cool. Yeah, I saw that, and as somebody who's got a solar panels, it's been hard to tell what's using, what days I'm using more power than other days, because if it's overcast outside, I'm not going to get nearly as much power generation from my array. And so you still can't tell where it's coming. This thing looks pretty cool.
Yeah, it's kind of like reading the power fingerprints of all the things in your house. And they've obviously know the power fingerprints for a bunch of different devices. And then others, they learn over time. But anyway, that's Sense.
Awesome.
Hey, so Paul, you got another one?
I do. I have a non-technical one here. So it's a simple little link, and this particular one is a link to time.com that lists the most frequent hosts on Saturday Night Live. And I'm showing this to you because if you scroll down to number four, there's a guy named Buck Henry. Who in the world is Buck Henry? Well, I'm looking through the pod show, and Paul has been on five times. Who the heck is Paul, and why has he been on the pod show five times? So I just found that to be very relevant and thought you'd appreciate that.
That's really cool. I like it.
Well played. Very well played.
Nice, nice. I see. You got another one for us?
I do. This is from the Visual Studio blog from the last day or two, and it's from one of the engineers on the Visual Studio team, but specifically Visual Studio for Mac. And it talks about some of the changes and stuff that they've been, features that they've been adding to it for Visual Studio for Mac that was released back in, I think, November of 2016. Some of the things that they've done that are really impressive, they've got a part here that's highlighting all the web editing implementations that they've done to make a little bit easier to build web applications. They've done a lot of stuff around .NET Core so that you've got a full first-class IDE to do .NET Core, both .NET Core and ASP.NET Core on a Mac, whereas before you really only had that in Visual Studio on Windows. We had it with Visual Studio Code, but again, it's just the code side. People aren't, you don't get all the designers and all that stuff. Also support for the latest Apple and Google platforms like macOS, iOS, tvOS, watchOS, a lot of testing improvements, improvements for C# 7, improvements for publishing straight to Azure. It's really cool. It's got a very in-depth article that kind of goes through a lot of different things that they've been improving on Visual Studio for Mac.
Gotcha. Very cool.
It sounds like they're getting a bit more parity to the Windows, which I can see being helpful.
Absolutely, yeah. And one more thing I do want to throw out there. I said it's one of the engineers on the Visual Studio team. Just to be clear, I know who this guy is. Miguel de Casa is not just one of the engineers on the Visual Studio team. Right? So before someone scrolls to the bottom and says, wait a minute, you don't know who that guy is? Yeah, I know who Miguel is.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah, he's a bit of a legend. My last pick before we wrap up is a YouTube video called How I Made My Own iPhone in China. And so this guy spent a bunch of time in China and Shenzhen and various other places and decided to try and make his own iPhone. And at first you think, wow, that's insane. There's no way. And then you watch how he does it and it's pretty impressive. So he basically goes to all the cell phone markets in Shenzhen and areas like that and goes and buys all of the parts to make an iPhone. So like the case, for example, the battery, the logic board, the camera, all this sort of stuff. And it's just mind-boggling. You see these markets with just thousands of parts from all over the place. It looks like complete and utter chaos to me. But he goes and he buys all these bits and puts them together and makes his own iPhone 6S, 16 gig, boots it up. It's running iOS, the whole nine yards. It's pretty sweet.
I'm going to find a link to something I watched recently from Wired, and I'll add this to your pick, but it's about a 1 hour long video on YouTube where they show the details around Shenzhen and how it's like this. Like if you had open source for software and you looked at a bunch of different communities around that, that's what Shenzhen's turned into. And all those goes into detail about the cell phone markets and everything. So it's a cool little add-on to your pick. So I'm going to piggyback off you on that one too.
Nice, nice. Hey, so Paul, thanks a lot for coming on the show and spending some time with us. It's been great chatting and we really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks for having me. Really had a great time.
Awesome. Thanks, Paul.
Cheers.
Did you like this episode? Please tweet about it and drop a 5-star review in iTunes. Word of mouth recommendations are the most effective ways for us to grow the show. We'd really appreciate it. If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text or record it as an MP3 or WAV file and provide a link so we can play your question on the show. Our theme music is brought to you by Keith Ritchie. For more information on Keith's music, head to music.kritchie.com. You can subscribe to us in iTunes and Google Play Store by searching for Microsoft Cloud Show or via RSS at microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll also find show notes of each episode. You can also find us on Facebook searching for Microsoft Cloud Show or on Twitter at MS Cloud Show. And finally, sign up for our mailing list by heading over to our website and entering your email to interact with us, participate in upcoming interviews, and other cool stuff. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.